What an astonishing thing a book is. It's a flat object made from a tree with flexible parts on which are imprinted lots of funny, dark squiggles. But one glance at it and you're inside the mind of another person, maybe somebody dead for thousands of years. Across the millennia, an author is speaking clearly and silently inside your head directly to you. Writing is perhaps the greatest of human inventions, binding together people who never knew each other, citizens of distant epochs. Books break the shackles of time. A book is proof that humans are capable of working magic. This is Carl Sagan talking about what makes books great. This is back in 1980. You know, and what's so weirdly compelling about this quote is that the magic of a book, you know, despite it being relatively simple as a piece of technology, I mean, incredibly simple as a piece of technology, has been in no way diminished by the onslaught of smartphones and ubiquitous internet. And when we say ubiquitous internet, we really mean ubiquitous internet. Go to the fields of Myanmar, and you will find farmers atop buffalo playing Clash of Clans on newly minted 3G networks. Walk into any cafe, any restaurant, and you will see a sea of people looking down at their phones. You know, and in fact, our state of always-on communication, of jumping from source to source, only strengthens the power that is a great book. But what is a great book in its most simple definition? To me, a great book is a piece of thinking in which usually one other person, you, who's hopefully an expert in their field or an expert of their own unique experience. And that's an important and kind of strange caveat, because sometimes people have had experiences, but they haven't put in the time to become experts of their own experience. And so you have this expert who has worked through a thought or collection of thoughts over and over again. These thoughts can be textual or visual or some combination therein. A refinement of a kind of thinking about a specific topic. That thinking or experience is distilled and then given to others as a gift, and I hope in a best case scenario, as a starting point for a deeper kind of dialogue. I've been working on and with books for over 15 years. As a designer, a publisher, a producer, and an author. And what I've realized over time is that the margins of a great book run deep. The more I've worked on my own books, the more I've come to realize that the white space and untold stories behind how and why a book is made are not only compelling, but essential. And it's within those margins that I want to spend some time. The first guest on this podcast is author Jan Chipchase, whose life is nothing if not oodles of white space, oodles of untold stories and unseen preparation in anticipation of sharing his insights with the world. And so today we're talking about his most recent book, The Field Study Handbook. So my name is Craig Mott. I'm here today with Jan Chipchase, and it's a very special day for Jan. He has in his hands something that he's been working on for a long, long time. Three years.
Intensively.
Super intensively. So, Jan, what is this that you have in your hand, and why are we talking this morning?
I've been working on a book called The Field Study Handbook, which is a guide to running international field research. Mm. Basically, it's a guide to traveling around the world, decoding culture, building teams, and helping clients figure out how the world out there affects how they think and what they should do next.
You gave me a sneak peek at this, and I'm really excited about it.
You're in it.
What? Oh, man. I'm going to need some royalties on this thing now. I'm really excited about this book because your life, your work-life balance for the last 15 years has been this endless source of fascination for so many of us in the world who are designers or travelers or ethnographers. And this book is a consolidation of all of that work and thinking of your life.
About fieldwork.
And yeah. How long is it?
524 pages.
Yeah, I mean, you just held it up for me. It looks like a Bible. It is definitely, it's a weapon. You could use that to attack people.
It's a handbook, but it's I just measured it for the first time. It's 1.75 inches.
Yeah.
That's
it's like a mitt. It's a mitt book. It's not really just for a hand. It's like for a giant's mitts.
For large handed people. But having said that, it does have 80 diagrams in it. It's not like all text. There's 80 diagrams. There's 50 illustrations in there. Lots of tables, case studies. It's well spaced out.
Yeah. I mean, what I love about it is, you know, you kind of couch it as this guide to doing field work. But really, I mean, you know, looking at the table of contents and reading the bits that you let me read and just having known you for years and talked to you about your work, this book it's a guide to living globally in a respectful way. I think the respect component is so big in this book. I love it. I mean, you sent me these little samples and so much of the sample was about respect.
There's a thing in our field, which is human-centered design, right? So putting people at the center of the process in some shape or form. And a lot of people talk about that as if you practice that, that the thing that you do will turn out good, as in good in the sense of be social and be good for society. But actually, the reality is you can use those tools for good and bad, right? You can make more money out of people without them realizing it. You can create solutions that shift balance of power in the favor of the few instead of the many. And there's many different ways that it can be applied. And actually, the ethics of how we do this and the intent behind how we do this is one of the most important parts of this process. And I'm sharing what I believe creates and draws in these rich and valid and sustainable ways of collecting data in the world out there and using it to make a difference. So yeah, thank you for picking up on that.
Yeah. I mean, in some parts of it read almost like a travel guide from the 1800s or something, you know, I mean, it really is we have this sense of the world kind of, you know, globalism sort of ironing out everything. And, you know, everywhere you go, it's a McDonald's and a McDonald's is a McDonald's is a McDonald's. But the reality is that they aren't all the same like that. I mean, there's a paragraph here I just want to read for a second where you're talking about forms of incentive. And, you know, you say, for example, for home-based sessions in China, it's common to arrive with gifts such as a watermelon and leave after handing over an envelope with cash. In Japan, small, fancy biscuits are an appropriate gift on arrival. In communities without refrigeration, which is, I love that, you know, it's like, yeah, you're going to be in places without refrigerators sometimes. It is better to turn up with a live animal that can be eaten in one sitting, such as a chicken. In countries where prepaid phones are common, airtime is an appropriate gift that can also be converted into cash. In one paragraph, and you have about a billion of these paragraphs like that. Mm. You know, it's this quick jump deep into places and ways of thinking about places that I think most people don't get to. Kudos. I like it.
Thank you. Yeah, I've been practicing this for 17 years now from my first job, and it's a privilege every day to be doing this kind of work.
Walk us through the elevator pitch of Jan's last 17 years.
Okay, the preamble to that is a degree in development economics in the UK. Joined a research institute at the University of Bristol, and then moved to Japan, where we didn't meet, surprisingly, because we were both up there. And I was in Japan for 10 years, and I worked initially as a very bad usability engineer, and then morphed into a concept designer. And this was at Nokia's research center in Tokyo. And then eventually made my way up to being principal scientist in the research center. And then in 2000, I left and I became a executive creative director of Global Insights, long job title, overseeing the research practice at Frog Design globally.
Mm. So you left Nokia at 2000?
2010. I was at Nokia 2000 to 2009, actually.
And then 2009, you joined Frog.
2010, I joined Frog, I think.
2010. So you were there in the Nokia like heyday, like the real, like when Nokia was a real company, it wasn't gutted. And you said, if you said a Nokia, I mean, that was essentially what, you know, is synonymous. It was like Kleenex for tissues. Nokia is a phone.
Pretty much, yeah. And I at that time, I was there. I joined just at the peak of their insane valuation. Now, if you look at any kind of market cap size valuation, you'll see a chart that looks Everest-esque. And I joined just at the peak of the Everest-esque-ness of it.
Well, hopefully you got paid only in options.
I got paid in love and elk biscuits or something.
Yummy.
But I worked on emerging markets, products that essentially at that time were being sold for about $70 and they went down to about $35. And these days, those kind of products you can probably get new for about $15 on the market. When the mobile phone went from being niche and very expensive to becoming a mass consumer product, I was there during the heyday of that and was fortunate enough to have done work that influenced the direction of that. And part of those stories are in the book as well.
And a lot of this was in, it wasn't in America. It was in deep China. It was in deep India.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. I was based out of Tokyo, but I spend pretty much for the last 17 years, I've spent up to half the year traveling the world and specializing in what was then called emerging markets. I think many of those markets have emerged and are starting to gobble up more developed markets. So places like India and China, Brazil, Afghanistan, Egypt, Bolivia, you name it. I've probably run a field study there.
And so, so you've basically spent 17 years being a professional traveler, because a lot of these projects aren't very long. They're, you know, maybe you have a week, maybe you have 2 weeks, maybe you have a month if you're lucky. You have to go super deep into a culture that maybe you haven't been to before.
Yep.
That could be vastly different than anything that you've experienced before. And you have to go deep in a way that's respectful and make sure everyone that's involved with the project doesn't feel like they're being taken advantage of. But you also get the information that you want to get from the folks who are participating. And then you made the transition of going completely independent a few years ago.
And then 3.5 years ago, I started my own studio, Studio D Radio Durams. And I'm continuing that work, but I do it for clients that I love.
And who are these clients that you love?
Commercial, non-profit, and governmental. There's a couple on the website, but to be honest, frankly, it's actually much easier to conduct the work when people don't know who the client is. So I like to keep those relationships a little bit discreet. There's a couple that the clients kind of wanted to push out, and they're on the website, studiodradiodurams.com.
Just for those listening, it's funny. I asked that because I just wanted to tease Jan, because Jan doesn't even tell me in private who he's working for. And it's always he's like the ultimate client tease. Like, he'll be like, oh, just finished this amazing thing that I can't tell you anything about. I'm like, come on, we're in a whiskey bar. Just tell me. No, can't do it. You'll know someday, Craig. That's the response I get.
There's two ways to know about the project, right? So one is to be the client, and the second one is to be hired onto the project. So come work with us again and we'll be working on some fantastic things. That's part of the fun, right? Is to work with people you respect. I certainly would like to invite you back.
Yeah, thank you. So you've spent 17 years kind of going deep into all these places. And what was you've had one other book come out. Mm-hmm. What was that book?
That's called Hidden in Plain Sight. And that was published by Harper Business. And that went through the formal book kind of publishing process, right? I mean, that was be approached by an agent and then sign with an agent and then a year spent on writing the proposal, finding a writer to work with as well, because I didn't have enough time. And I'm not even convinced at that time I had the skills to write consistently. And then another year writing the book. And then you kind of hand it over, right? And like 9 months later, it appears on the shelves. And it's this kind of slightly, it's lovely to see it out there. And it did okay in the US, nothing special, but did pretty well in Japan, Taiwan, and actually strangely became a bestseller in South Korea.
The trick is you only need to sell 7 copies in South Korea to be a bestseller.
Three.
Okay. A little known cultural fact. No one in South Korea reads books. So if you sell 3, you're on the top of the list. Yeah. What was that book about?
That book was about decoding culture, but that was really about how to see the world differently by asking questions that are maybe a little unusual that you're not used to answering. The kind of questions that you gave up answering when you turned 10 because you'd figured stuff out, right? And so you no longer saw the world through fresh eyes. For example, why don't people write in the shower? Or why do people go to the bathroom when they do and not before or not after? What compels us to have a particular kind of behavior? And these are really obvious questions. But when you delve into them and you unpack them and you look at all the things around them and you put them into a cultural context, you end up with this. You end up revealing things that you never really knew when you started out. And a lot of our clients, they have, I mean, literally they're awash in data, right? They have tons of marketing data. Increasingly, they have data analytics, so live or near-time data based on actual usage. And that tells them a lot about what people are doing, and it tells them a huge amount about how they're doing it. But really, they're missing, the most important component, which is why people are behaving while they do. And for that, you need to understand context. And so what I do when I run these projects is I help organizations understand why. And fundamentally, if you understand why, it can take you in a very, very different direction than if you only understood what or how. And that's kind of the crux of it.
And so if this first book is about like figuring out how to get back to beginner's mind, approaching things with a set of seemingly obvious questions, but that help you get to the why of why people are doing stuff, is the field study handbook sort of the how to go ask those whys? To get to those whys?
It's two things, yeah. It's one part of it is the how-to. So literally it will take you from the initial pitch of this is why I think we should invest in this kind of research to help inform what we're doing in our organization or to a client, through to running that project, through to figuring out how to build an international team that you have a trusted relationship with that gives you a better opportunity of getting to the real kind of crux of the matter or the closer to the truth. All the way through to delivering it and sharing it, right? And that process of sharing in such a way that you actually influence people around you. You want to inform them and you also want to inspire them. A lot of organizations have left brains and right brains, and you have to appeal to both sides of it. So it literally is, that's the how-to. You know, there's a lot of people, particularly they put out kits, follow these five steps, you'll figure that stuff out. But really, I think it's missing the biggest component, which is how do you align your own intent? How do you kind of confront your own intent for why you want to do this? Because everyone wants to travel. Nobody says no to it, right? Especially to interesting places. So how do you confront that? And how do you help understand what your organization's intent is? And how do you redirect that intent to something with a greater alignment to what people actually want and need, rather than just what the organization wants, thinks it wants and needs, based on a different kind of data? The why to, for me, I don't think anyone's written a why to book for this kind of stuff.
A lot of these projects seem fraught with potential for ethically fuzzy stuff to happen. And how do you think about that and how do you deal with that?
I've been practicing for many years, and I'm not saying that there aren't logistical challenges to run it, but probably the most interesting thing on any project is the ethical issues that you confront. Because the world is very fuzzy, and a lot of the places that I work have a very kind of variable rule of law. Sometimes the police are the most corrupt people there, or the most obviously corrupt institution. And so, you know, we get hustled for bribes and shaken down, and we need to figure out what's going on. But we want to do it, and we want to come out of it with a smile on our face for the right reasons, right? For me, the ethical component really always starts with the local team. When people hire us, or when people think about what we do, is they think we decode culture, which we do. But actually, we decode culture and local cultures, and for that we need a local team. But we translate it to an organization and to a project. And if you don't understand that organization, and if you can't speak the language of that organization, then you've failed. And so we're really a bridge between the local culture and the organization and what they're trying to do. So the first part of that is building a local team that trusts you. It's not necessarily absolute trust. Occasionally it is absolute trust, as in life and death trust. But for most projects, it's a degree of trust. That
Can you give an example of a life and death trust situation?
Well, okay, let's start with a slightly more trivial one, which is when you land somewhere and someone is showing you around and they're introducing you to their social network, their body language cues that they will make that introduction. If they do not trust you, if there's any suspicion, that will come through unconsciously in the way that they communicate with their peers, and their peers will pick up on it, or the neighborhood will pick up on it, right? And so you end up with a distorted view of things. People may want to tell the truth also, but they don't necessarily remember accurately. And so there's all these different ways of getting to this notion of the truth. But so the question of higher risk places, I think one of the projects in Afghanistan, we had a local crew. One of the local crew was offered a large sum of money to facilitate a kidnapping in one of my colleagues. That's what I was told by the local crew. There are so many different ways that that could play out. It may not have been true. That person may have been wanting to raise their profile. I doubt it, with the relationship that we had with them. It may be that someone did make that offer, but they weren't going to follow through on it. They may have been using it to blackmail person. If they had accepted, they may blackmail them. It may be true, and they might have killed that person. But the point being is, in those situations where that kind of thing arises, you want to make sure that there is a local person on the ground who puts you and your team ahead of these other opportunities that may arise. And you do that by building trust. And how do you build trust? Fundamental the world over, it's about showing respect from day one. Also, earning respect in negotiating appropriately. And, you know, like if you pay over the odds in Burundi for a guide, you'll be considered an idiot. If you pay under the odds in Burundi for a guide, you'll be considered an exploitative local. And there's a million and one interactions where it's actually very subtle about whether you can pull it off or not. And all of those things go into a process of building trust. Another thing that we do to build trust is we tend to hire a place, which we call a pop-up studio, a live workspace where we like to have our international team and our local team working side by side. And I strongly believe that a team that sits around the same table and drinks water from the same jug and sits on the same toilet or squats on the same toilet as well has a very different level of trust than one that meets in a hotel lobby in the morning and then goes out.
Sure.
And I mean, you've been in a pop-up studio. You've experienced some of that, right? And that's one of the steps in building trust.
Yeah, I think that's completely true. Well, just to bring up an example, like a really banal example of how trust gets you closer to truth more quickly. So from, you know, I learned when I was working with your team out in Myanmar a year and a half ago, you know, for example, you go into someone's home and you ask them, how many times a day do you call, you know, your spouse? They'll inevitably say something. They'll, you know, two or three times. You say, can I just see your phone? Is that okay? You know, and so like having that trust where they're willing to give you their phone, where you can look at their call records. And then in looking at the call records, you realize, oh, it's totally not what they thought the number was. And so it's like getting to that truth of living experience, culture, or whatever is completely contingent on having that trust and building that trust in the case of going to someone's home within minutes, right?
It may seem like it's within minutes, but really you've built trust with a layer around that home with people who have that established relationship.
Right.
So, and really the book shows you how to build a team anywhere in the world with a sufficient level of trust. It isn't a thing that you can just go out to read the book and go out tomorrow and it's all going to work. It takes a lot of practice to read social situations. And this isn't a become a researcher in the next hour book. This is a what direction do you want your life to take? And if you want to decode and understand the world out there, I will give you the tools and I think a kind of ethical framework in which to approach that. And it'll be very, I believe your life will be more rewarding for it. My one certainly has been. And I think through the work that I've conducted, I think we've impacted quite a few people.
Well, and even if you're not doing work, even if you're just traveling on your own, there is something tremendously powerful about this text and all of the lessons that you have put into this, in the sense of if you're traveling alone and you're going to a country, there is a skill set. Totally. It's totally a skill set to go deep in a way that is meaningful, that is not superficial, that is getting off the beaten paths in interesting getting off the beaten paths in a way that isn't obsessive about getting off the beaten paths, that is more of a kind of a natural flow into the culture, into a different country. And one of the great gifts of this book is sharing that, sharing those small little insights about making yourself a better traveler, a better person, a better global citizen. And what's also cool about this book is that it's a self-published enterprise.
It is. And not only that, the reason why it came into being is 6 years ago, you published ArtSpace Tokyo.
Mm.
And I was so impressed with a human being going through the process of creating this beautiful, tangible object. And you did such a great write-up of the backstory to that, that I thought it was possible.
Hmm.
And that was six years ago. And I was just starting writing the field, Hidden in Plain Sight. And so those 2 years of that process, I was taking notes for the Field Study Handbook. And then after those 2 years, I've spent 4 years pretty much every day 4 years working on this book with a goal of publishing it myself.
Part of the impetus was reading the Kickstarter essay about sort of self-publishing and the accessibility of it and things like that. And then was there anything about the last process that you didn't like that you wanted to, pushing it through the traditional machine? Was there something that you didn't find comfortable about that or?
Well, first off, I've got to say I'm very grateful for my editor.
Sure.
And Simon, the writer, and the team involved. That said, and I learned a lot from the process, right? And kind of I learned about whether you can take credit for success in a way. It may sound weird because there's so many people involved in the process.
Sure.
And whether you should take responsibility for failure as well, right? If it doesn't do well in a market. But really, once the book was finished and it was handed over, it just felt like it belonged to someone else. And when the sales started, you know, I didn't really get a sense of impetus or feedback. And since that book came out, I actually published a couple of ebooks. They're PDFs you can download from the site. And I actually have a closer relationship to the people who purchased that because they got a little ding.
Sure.
This human being has invested $4.99 in spending time on something that you've written. And that's that commitment to an idea and spending time is more meaningful to me than a royalty, an advance on a book or a royalty check. And so with the the Field Study Handbook, I wanted to be much closer to that process.
Right. Well, so, and probably in having done one, I think it's important for people to, you know, to pushing a book through a traditional system, I think is you learn a lot. And I also think that it's easy to kind of poo-poo that stuff. It's easy today to say, oh, everyone should self-publish or everyone, you know, forget the, you know, the big five or whatever, big six, big four, whatever they've consolidated down to now. You know, it's easy to say those things, but I think there's tremendous value in traditional publishing systems. For certain kinds of books, it's really unbeatable. And for getting to certain corners of certain markets, it's almost impossible to do on your own as an indie publisher. Also, if you are lucky enough to not need an advance, if you have other work that you're able to use to that doesn't take up 100% of your time and gives you a little bit of time, you've done an incredible job, I think, of creating space in your life to work on the Field Study Handbook, despite having every excuse in the world not to be doing it. And so if you have that kind of self-discipline and you don't need the advances and things like that, then I think it can be wonderful. And then now that you're sort of on the cusp of putting this thing out into the world. And in fact, you're so on the cusp that you just came back from somewhere a couple of days ago where you were looking at something connected to the book. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure, yeah. So I just come back from Iceland. I spec the book and reached out to a number of printers in the US, Canada, and Iceland. And Iceland just felt like the right fit. It's Oddi Printing in Reykjavik. So I've just come back from a 4-day trip to Iceland. That was fun.
Nice. Actually, you know, Odie was the printer of the first book that I ever designed myself.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So Kuhaku was the first book that I worked on, and they were printed at Odie because Odie was the printer that McSweeney's used for the most part. And back in the early 2000s, late 90s, if you're doing any kind of indie-ish publishing, McSweeney's was sort of your patron saint. And so we kind of stalked them and stalked their colophones and copyright pages. And we're like, where are they doing these things? And so, yeah, ended up going to Odie as well. It's kind of funny. It's almost like a rite of passage to go have something printed in Iceland. Well, they're the only printer in Iceland, right? Aren't they?
No, there's a couple of other much smaller printers. They were very accommodating and created this beautiful mock-up of the book itself.
And speaking of beautiful, I mean, this is a gorgeous looking book. Can you explain the cover a little bit?
The book is illustrated by Lee John Phillips, who's a technical illustrator in Narberth, Wales. He's incredibly talented. You should Lee John Phillips on Instagram. You'll see what I mean. We took one of his pictures, which was a garlic bulb, and we blew it up. And in blowing it up, it feels like a contour map of a mountain or something like that. Mm. And I wanted to have something that kind of survived the squint test. So you look at it and you're not quite sure, like, is that a landscape? Is that a... And then when you open the book itself, you'll see that there is the smaller, finer version of that exactly in all its technical penmanship beauty.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's the thing. These illustrations, it has to be said, are just like, you just want to lick the pages. I mean, they have that, it's sort of that Wall Street Journal dot pattern style, but with more pizzazz and a little more of like the human hand involved. And they just look gorgeous. I mean, they're the sort of thing that a filter couldn't do justice to with a photograph. But this man in Wales, he does magic with his black and white lines. It's pretty incredible. And you have a hit of color on the cover as well.
Yeah, there's a little splash of color. Originally, we're thinking of just selling through Amazon. So they will drop ship from Oddie's warehouse in Maine, where they ship things to import them into the US, through to the Amazon warehouse and put it on sale there. So yeah, there's a splash of color. And I think part of the reason was that we wanted it, so I'm working with my creative director here in the studio, Keiko Moon. We wanted it to survive the squint test on Amazon. So we wanted it to work at a thumbnail. And I think some of the, like if you think of Queer Bound, your own book, that's quite a subtle book to put on an Amazon page.
Yeah.
And have distinctive in a lineup. So that little splash of color is to make it a little bit more distinctive, especially across different kind of collateral.
Well, I think it looks great. And
thank you.
Yeah, I mean, and what font are you using on the cover there?
Well, that will be definitely ripped off ArtSpace Tokyo. It is Fedra Sans Standard and Fedra Serif Standard. We also use condensed on the diagrams.
Fedra, I mean, I love Fedra. I mean, when I was doing lots of book design 10 years ago, I had these moments where I just spend weeks going through every font I could possibly find. And Fedra was the family that I kind of committed to. I married Fedra, basically, as a book designer. Koya Bound is also Fedra.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. So, I use Fedra for everything, and I'm sort of not ashamed of it. It's so good. It's so beautiful. It's a beautiful, distinctive, highly readable, but has its own character, but doesn't overwhelm the page. It just feels great. It's from Typotech over in, I think, the Netherlands.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, it does a great job in supporting different character sets as well. They've really internationalized it.
Yeah, yeah, it's wonderful. So I think you should think about doing a Kickstarter for this thing. I mean, it just feels, because you also run a luggage company. Like, it just feels like there's such an obvious confluence between the kind of amazing gear that you're producing and what this book entices people to go do in the world.
Yeah. Maybe a little context to that. So when I was studying the book around the same time, I was commissioned a custom piece of luggage for the kind of travel I do. Basically, I want to be able to carry stuff, sometimes a lot of expensive stuff, and actually sometimes a lot of cash, because we have to pay payroll for a team of 20 people or however many people in cash sometimes.
And you might be in a place, and you'll be in a place that has no banks or ATMs.
Yes, but a lot of people with sticky fingers and a lot of checkpoints. And so I wanted a piece of luggage that basically people ignored and would be less likely to be pulled aside at checkpoints and check-ins. I could carry on. It sits under a seat on the plane. So I designed a piece of luggage. It's called the D3. It's a duffel. It's made from this ultralight, amazing ultralight material called Dyneema. It's particularly a blend of that. It's about twice the strength of Kevlar, or if you want to put it another way, half the weight of Kevlar for the same tensile strength. And it floats in water. It's that light as well. And I made a piece of luggage for that. And then a year later, I made another prototype. And then people like yourself saw it and said, hey, can I have one? And so I made 10, and there were 10 beta testers, of which you were one. And I remember you feeding back the report into the D3 owner's manual, which we had online, this big Google Doc. This is before it was a company or even decided, before I decided to even sell it. And then 3 and a bit years ago, I launched it as a luggage brand. And we make duffels and travel accessories for field work. And one of the things that we're going to do for the launch of the book is introduce a couple of new items specifically for field work. So if you buy the book and you like to get out there and take notes and figure out what's going on in the world out there and document it, have I got something for you.
Nice. Well, I mean, I think this the D3, that piece of luggage, is a great example of, like, from the outside, you look at it and you go, so you have the D3, and then you have this other thing called the Holly, right? So it's like it holds $1 million in used $20 bills. You know, it's like just enough size. And so from the outside, you look at it and you go, you know, this is for drug cartels in South America. What's this? But no, I mean, you have literally been in the field in places where there are lots of ATMs, where you have to pay a bunch of people a bunch of cash out in the field, and you have to be carrying the equivalent of $1 million. And so this comes out of that need. I love
that. There are people who have jobs where they need to carry a lot of cash. And it's actually not used 20s. It's used or new $100 bills.
Okay. 20s would be insane.
It would be insane. It would be five times the weight. So,
yes. But that piece of luggage as being born directly from a real need in the field, and then this book as being an enticement into the field, and that piece of luggage as existing feels like a kind of a cool, I don't know, I can just see the Kickstarter campaign that's like, get the book and the luggage, they go together.
Maybe similar to yourself is, if you do interesting work and you interact with people who are leading interesting lives, it tends to generate its own momentum for new interesting things, right? Things to keep you engaged and pushing you at the boundary of your craft. And I think with the luggage, in creating these things, we ended up with attracting conversations from people who are pushing the boundaries. They are in places where they are carrying the $1 million and they want to have that additional protection.
So who do you think the audience is for this field study handbook? Do you think it's like, is it a designer in a startup in Silicon Valley? Is it someone who's working for a think tank in Washington, D.C.? Is it, you know, someone who's an independent consultant? Like, who is sort of the people that you're trying to touch with this book?
The field study handbook is for anyone that wants to understand what is going on in the world. And most of the people who currently practice that are designers, strategists, they're in brand communications, public policy partnerships. Because the emphasis on the handbook is about international research, it really will support anyone who is creating anything that is used beyond their borders, right? They have to think beyond what they know. And I give them the tools and the techniques to be able to go beyond their borders and bring that into their organization, into their work life. That's on one level. I think there's another thing is, I think it's for anyone who is a traveler who wishes to travel and who wishes to understand more about the places that they travel to. They want to have a kind of richer, more rewarding travel experience. So in that sense, it's for everyone, I think.
But this feels like a book for living in the future. It feels like the inevitable direction we're moving in is one of a more globalized universe, globalized Earth, where more cultures are interacting with other cultures than ever before in the history of humanity. And despite recent nationalist tendencies, the future pattern is inexorably globalized living. And this book feels like a blueprint for living in that future. And that if you work in any industry that touches the world, you are going to get value from it.
Yes. It's a book for coexisting.
It's a book from the future. about an ideal, the utopian version of where the world could possibly head.
Yeah, and well, you say utopian, but it's not dystopian, but it isn't that shiny utopian thing, right?
Sure.
That vision, it's a very messy and beautiful and gloopy, dusty, touchy, feely, snotty kind of version of the world. It's the real world.
When I say utopian, I mean in the sense of like, this is the utopian traveler. This is the ideal traveler, is someone who thinks about the world in this way, approaches other cultures with this kind of respect and openness and open mind and open heart, and is curious and hungry. And it's a book without malice. The world can be messy and the world will be messy, but it feels like it's a handbook that comes from a kind place. And when I say utopian, I think my goal, I think it'd be ideal if everyone approached the world from this kind place. And so, I don't know, it seems like a good stake in the ground.
Yeah, and we've costed it actually to be as accessible. It's pretty hefty and print costs are pretty high, but we've costed it to be as accessible as possible.
Will it ever be released just digitally? Right. For now, it's only in print.
It's only
right?
in hardback. And yeah. I just devoted all my energy and my family's energy and the studio's energy into getting it to this place. And I'm just going to put it out there and see the reaction to it and then figure out what I want to do next.
I think this is the right sequence because artifacts, printed things, stuff that you can hold in your hand, things that you can hold in your hand have a certain power about setting intentions and also about being present in someone's life. You know, a book sitting on a table is going to call someone to try something far more frequently than a PDF lost in a folder or, you know, a Kindle book lost in a Kindle that's sitting in a drawer or something like that. So I think it's a great place to start from the artifact. And then I'm definitely going to push you to open this up in many different ways, eventually either through websites, super accessible websites or digital downloads or digital education stuff. I'm going to push very hard for that in the future, but I think this is a great starting point.
Well, my studio does offer training for organizations. I mean, we do run field research around the world as well. You can hire us in if you want to run a larger scale project. One of the things that I enjoyed about ArtSpace Tokyo was when you put it out in the world, there was the backstory to it. That was such a rich component, particularly at that time where that wasn't so widely available and wasn't so necessarily beautifully articulated. And with the field study handbook, there's a number of components to it. So there's the luggage component and the field study accessories component, which comes through our own luggage brand. There's training and workshops. I mean, that's there too. There's things like wallpaper downloads for Lee's beautiful illustrations. And then there's a second smaller book called Sustainable Data. Mm. And I believe that's the only book that could be filed under the Library of Congress under Data, Ethics, Gardening, and Cookery.
A book is the start of this constellation of work and connections and interactions and discussions. And it sounds like there's a bunch of cool stuff coming out connected with this.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it all comes back to the conversations that it starts, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And what those conversations lead to in terms of a life lived in journeys undertaking, people that we love and feel close to, right?
A life well lived.
Yeah. Who can ask for anything more?
Great. Well, thank you, Jan, for making the time today to chat.
Thank you, Craig, for having me on your podcast.
Yeah.
What is the podcast called, by the way?
It's called Let's Talk About Books.
Okay. Did we talk about books? Yeah, I guess we did a bit.
But we'll have links to all this stuff down below, or wherever below or above, wherever it lives in whatever thing you're listening to this in. How do you end these things?
I think you need a jingle.
We're done.